Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. We'll be looking at what makes the United Arab Emirates one of Zimbabwe's largest trading partners and if China's business interests are still significant. And from rebel to teacher, the story of a former separatist fighter promoting peace in Cameroon.
I was sleeping with her in one of the small rooms. Out of a sudden, at about 5 a.m. in the morning, we got gunshot being fired everywhere. I couldn't check on my wife. All I could do was to save my own life. We came back to discover that my 11-year-old child was dead.
It's Thursday, February 13th. First, we go to Tanzania. The African Court on Human and People's Rights is holding a public hearing on a case filed by the Democratic Republic of Congo against Rwanda. The DRC accuses Rwanda of violating its sovereignty, orchestrating violence, and destabilizing eastern Congo through alleged support for the M23 rebel group. The case is taking place in Tanzania, where the court has its base. The conflict has displaced over 500,000 people and led to a humanitarian crisis. Rwanda denies the accusations. The court's ruling could set a major precedent for handling cross-border conflicts in Africa. What do we know about the African court? Here is my colleague Bella Hassan with an explainer on the court itself.
The African Court is the judicial arm of the African Union, and its permanent seat is in Arusha, Tanzania. The court was established to protect human and people's rights in Africa, principally through judicial consideration of human rights complaints. The Protocol for Africa Court was adopted in 1998 in Burkina Faso. It entered into force in 2004. At the time, it was ratified by just 15 African states. It applies the provisions of the African Charter on Human Rights and People's Rights and other human rights instruments ratified by the states concerned. It does not have criminal jurisdiction, like the International Criminal Court. The vision of the court is an Africa with a viable human rights culture, and it bases its core values on the African Charter and other internationally recognized principles of human rights and the promotion of the rule of law. Only 34 member states have currently ratified the protocol of the African Court. At the moment, the court is hearing the case between DRC and Rwanda. It's a case that could set the precedent for how Africa handles cross-border conflicts. We will find out what that means, and also how much power the court really has.
Many thanks to Bella. So, how effective is the African Court on Human and People's Rights? Franz Folioun is a professor of international human rights law at the University of Pretoria.
It has been set up by the African Union, right, which is an institution of all African governments or states. And those states that have accepted the jurisdiction of the court, they undertake to abide by the decisions of the court. So in law, they definitely have to give effect to the decisions. But, you know, from time to time, they do not. And then the responsibility to make those decisions effective really go back to the states. It's the other states that have to now exert pressure, impose sanctions, and, you know, coax the state that is not complying to move towards compliance. And yes, that may be a longer process, a process that is infused with politics, and ordinary Africans, people in civil society, they should all contribute to put pressure on the state to, you know, implement those decisions. But yes, it is a kind of 50-50 game here.
I noticed you say that those countries that have accepted for the court to operate within their country, given that it's established by the African Union, is it not obvious that perhaps all the countries in Africa that are members of the AU would be happy to support the court?
Well, the African Union has 55 member states, and so far 34 of them have accepted the jurisdiction of the court. You know, the court was not there initially. It was brought into being by what is called a protocol, a legal instrument, a legal document, and states have the option And that was since about, you know, the end of 2000 that this option was open. So 34 states, I think, you know, in all regions of the world where such courts exist, those would be optional. And, you know, over time, you know, more and more states would accept. But it's quite common maybe for all states to not be party. If you think Africa is a very varied continent, and, you know, I could perhaps just use one example, a state like Eritrea, you know, it's even in the UN under specific scrutiny for human rights violations. You would not really expect that state to be a state party, to become party, to accept the court's jurisdiction, because this is a human rights court. So regrettably, there are some states in Africa whose human rights records are really nothing to write home about. And it is acceptable, I think, that those are not, you know, it strengthens the court. It's, the court is like a club of those states that are seriously committed to human rights, that have accepted the jurisdiction of the court. And that may not be true that it is continent-wide, but I don't think that's an impediment to the court's functioning.
Before we move on, so it's Eritrea. What are some of the other countries, maybe you can name two or three influential countries on the continent that have not implemented the court in their countries?
Well, we would not be surprised. Zimbabwe is one. Zimbabwe has a long-standing issue with human rights, you know, over time. That is not a state party. A big country like Egypt is not a state party. Egypt, you know, even the UN system is sometimes reluctant to accept, you know, international scrutiny of its domestic record. So it has a bit of an ambiguous record in human rights. And, you know, there are certain issues that recur also in Egypt. So those would be examples of prominent states. Even Ethiopia, where the African Union headquarters are based, is not a state party to the court protocol, perhaps also because of the very difficult ethnic tensions and issues around civil unrest and, you know, instability that are still prevailing in Ethiopia.
So this case ongoing on the DRC against Rwanda, what's your take on it?
Well, it is quite exciting and interesting because it's the first time that one state complaints against another state. So this African court, usually who comes to the court are individuals or NGOs, right? Individuals or NGOs allege that the government in which they find themselves have violated their rights. This one is different, right? Because it is one state, the Democratic Republic of Congo, bringing a case against another state, Rwanda. But it again alleges that human rights violations have taken place. So they say that DRC is violating the rights of people in the Republic of Rwanda. I think we all know that there's a very serious situation of instability and conflict ongoing. And I think it is very reassuring that the DRC at least is using a mechanism that is not conflictual. It tries to deflect the conflict into something that we can call, you know, amicable resolution or judicial resolution of a dispute. And that is a very good sign that it kind of reinforces the value of multilateral institutions and judicial means of settling conflicts between states. And in that way, I think it is a very, very remarkable first case in this regard.
Right. So it is said that the ruling out of this case will have broader implications for cross-border conflicts on the continent. What do you think that means, and what would that look like?
Well, you know, yes, I'm sure that if there is eventually a finding of violation of human rights by the court, you know, that Rwanda is found in violation, then, you know, this would certainly also be important to other states to know that these mechanisms are available and possible. But I think we should not overstate it. First of all, we should take this one step at a time. You know, this case is now at a phase where the jurisdiction and the admissibility. So these procedural matters have to be settled first. So the case as it is being heard in Arusha today, yesterday, does not deal with the merits. It does not deal with the question if there are human rights violations. It deals with preliminary issues, whether the court has jurisdiction at all, whether the court is the right place for this matter. And, you know, Rwanda is putting a lot of emphasis on all kinds of reasons why it believes or it argues the case is not admissible. So this hurdle, I just want to emphasize, has to be crossed first. So when the court gives a judgment now, in a few months' time, the judgment will only be on these preliminary issues.
You said that, you know, it's not always the case that the judgments will be complied by the state parties to this court. In this case, this has been a very long-running conflict. Assuming the case, like you're saying, you think they are going to allow, you know, they will say that there was jurisdiction, it has jurisdiction to hear this case. How do you think that will go in terms of compliance and implementation by these two countries?
Well, it is interesting, you know, that There is another body, just to not complicate things, but there is also an African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Before the court was instituted or created, there was this commission, and it's still there. Today, the commission is like a first port of call that people can go to with complaints. And then, you know, you can also go to the court. The commission gives like recommendations, and the court gives binding decisions. Now, there was a few years back, you know, in the previous series of conflicts between these countries, there was a case before the African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Again, it was DRC against Rwanda, but also Burundi and Uganda at the time. And to say that, you know, the outcome of that case was not very positive in the sense that the compensation and so on that the commission ordered or recommended was not paid. But at the same time, there was also a case before the International Court of Justice between the DRC and Uganda. So, you know, that case led to a conclusion by the ICJ maybe a decade ago that there were violations and that amount of compensation had to be paid. And Uganda actually paid over time, maybe not fully, but it is in the process, it seems, to be paying that compensation. So I'm just saying all of these because I think, you know, when an international court like the ICJ and when an African Union court makes a finding, states do take notice. States will be quite reluctant, I think, to totally disregard the court's order because they want to be seen to be, you know, upstanding members of the African Union. And it's difficult now to say, oh, this is some kind of foreign intervention. It is the African Union court, which these states have accepted, that has given the judgment. So I'm modestly optimistic that at least there will not be total disregard if the court comes to find against the Republic of Rwanda in the end.
Franz Folion, Professor of International Human Rights Law at the University of Pretoria. The United Arab Emirates has, according to reports, rapidly emerged as one of Zimbabwe's largest trading partner, investing over $1 billion in real estate and gold trading. Many of you will know that Zimbabwe is renowned for having one of the world's worst economic meltdowns when hyperinflation in 2007 to 2009 led to the country abandoning its currency. The economy is mostly informal, and high debt and high inflation remain its Achilles heel. Now, these reports say that despite the country's debt burden, which has risen to around $21 billion since 1999, the UAE has regularly been one of the Southern African country's top five foreign direct investment sources. So, does this growing partnership with the UAE mark a significant shift in global influence in Zimbabwe as Western nations remain hesitant to invest? Also, is China scaling back on investment in the country or not? I've been speaking to Chenaye Mutambasere, a Zimbabwean development economist from the African Center for Economic Justice. She began by telling me if the economic partnership between these two countries is new.
It's not a new relationship. Technically speaking, the UAE has been having diplomatic relations with Zimbabwe from as early as the mid-90s. We have seen it being strengthened, stronger, and a lot more investment coming from the UAE in recent years. What is new, however, is the fact that we are here today talking about it. And what we have seen happen in the past in Zimbabwe is these announcements of bilateral relations, such as Mugabe launched his 2005 Look East policy, certainly follow a political path. So it's what are the political undertones that are being presented here, I think, is worth noting.
So in your opinion, how did the UAE become the largest investment and trading partner with Zimbabwe?
I would take that statement of the UAE being the largest with a bit of a pinch of salt. And why I say this is because Zimbabwe ordinarily has not been good at tracking sort of open reporting when it comes to its contractual relationships, particularly in the mining sector. So whilst we're looking at the level of investment from the UAE, and this being recorded as being the largest bilateral relation, when we look at 2024, however, and the foreign investment licenses that were issued via the Zimbabwe Investment Authority, we find that China still predominantly was issued with the majority of licenses, particularly in the mining sector. So what we're looking at here potentially is the recorded return on investment. And this is why perhaps it's looking as though UAE is having this significant investment in Zimbabwe. But we must look at this in line with transparency and what the data would be telling us if it was collectively available.
How big a role does China then continue to play in Zimbabwe? And are there other big countries that are investing in a big way still besides the UAE?
What's important to mention, Charles, is that when it comes to investment, particularly in mining in Zimbabwe, the mining laws are such that there isn't a direct relationship between who is actually working on the mining claims and who holds the mining license. And I'll explain this in that the process of getting a mining claim means that, for instance, we're issuing them out to a lot of UAE investors and a lot of Chinese investors. However, what happens next is that we have the presence of artisanal, small-scale miners who are not recorded or registered anyway, and they are then being subcontracted by those that host the mining claims. So it's very difficult to track the relationship between, do we have predominantly Chinese investors or predominantly UAE or other investors? Just because you look at mining, nearly 60% or more is being produced by the artisanal miners that are not necessarily registered or recorded anyway. So we can then track using the issuing of investment licenses. And what that is looking at the moment is that these licenses are being issued more predominantly to Chinese investors than they are to the UAE investors. But that said, the idea of a $2 billion investment coming out of the UAE, it introduces another sector, which is the real estate sector, which has seen growing interest from UAE investors. And so that's quite significant because that hasn't necessarily been a key sector in terms of economic growth in Zimbabwe. So it will be interesting to see how much return is pushed into the economy via this route.
But one would look at this, you know, over $1.4 billion invested by the UAE in real estate and gold trading in Zimbabwe. Doesn't this show that the UAE is sort of an emerging power within the country's ecosystem? And would the Chinese investor, or even China itself, would they be looking at this, that there's an upcoming sheriff in town, I would say, given what you're saying?
I mean, potentially, but, you know, sometimes it comes down to who got there first. And I think the Chinese interest is quite significant in quite a lot of the key mining sectors in Zimbabwe, and even from an official perspective. So you look at chrome, you have one of our biggest chrome companies is very much Chinese owned. You look at diamond, you look at Kiadzwa, which is our biggest diamond produce. And that is predominantly, I think quite a few of those units are owned, have got Chinese interests, and the same with gold. So it's good for Zimbabwe, I suppose, that we have another key investor, another key bilateral investor. But when you consider the mining industry in Zimbabwe is more than 12 billion. So there's still quite a lot of potential for new players and even for the existing ones to grow. But as I've said, the lack of transparency in terms of data and what is happening within this sector really makes it difficult to really call it out to say, you know, is this a significant partner coming alongside China? Is China becoming less of a partner? But there's still a long way to go, I think, for UAE to be considered even more significant or as significant as China's interest in Zimbabwe.
So how then is Zimbabwe benefiting from this partnership with the UAE?
Well, this is where, you know, the story kind of falls off. You know, we are seeing all these new licensings being issued, whether it is to the UAE investors or Chinese investors. But when you look at our economic growth in Zimbabwe, when you look at economic stability, this is not playing out. We are not seeing any significant economic growth coming out of these investments. Zimbabwe at the moment is still standing at a position of nearly 6 million of its citizens, which is nearly half the population, are living in extreme poverty. And that figure hasn't shifted for at least the last 3 years. We're looking at inflation that continues to rise. We're looking at a deflating local currency and continued economic instability. You know, the additional sectors such as the manufacturing sectors that might benefit from an increase or an interest in mining are not benefiting. We're not seeing any significant growth necessarily coming into those sectors. So for Zimbabwe, unfortunately, because of the deep structural issues that we have that are nuanced really on the politics, the return on investment is minimal, is limited, and it is not yet being realized by the people of Zimbabwe.
So, Chennai, there have been headlines about this, UAE's presence in Zimbabwe. I can quote one by Bloomberg recently, and they said that shunned by the West, Zimbabwe gets lifeline with UAE. Could you tell us why they would say something like that? And
I think we can recognize the investment, but actually calling it an economic lifeline is a bit of an overreach. We've had reports from organizations such as Transparency International who have said Zimbabwe loses nearly over $100 million a month to corruption. And there's been no efforts by the current government to improve on that. So we cannot really speak of economic lifeline when we are seeing a leakage the extent of $100 million a month. You know, so that is a bit of an overreach, I would say.
So in closing, and in a few words, what does the government, what does the country need to do to be able to capitalize on the investors that are still coming in?
Okay, so initially, Zimbabwe needs to resolve their political issue. And I think because this is the bedrock of all their problems. Currently, in terms of our debt crisis, there hasn't been a way to really reduce or renegotiate our debt, because when the debt dialogue conversations began, this was anchored on having a free and fair election. And when that didn't materialize, we have seen the US, the EU and other countries actually exiting the debt dialogue talks. So before we even go into what the other structural issues are, Zimbabwe is losing a lot of money because they have to pay off the interest. And I think the organization put it at nearly, it's going to take us 99 years to even begin to address today's debt, but also to introduce more transparency into the system and to get rid of poor monetary policies that are currently resulting in huge market distortions, which have made life difficult for the people of Zimbabwe.
Chinayi Mutambasere, development economist from Africa Center for Economic Justice. The ruling party in Zimbabwe has always maintained that elections have been free and fair. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. For a year and a half, Atia Song Belt Tajua fought with the Red Dragons, a separatist militia in Cameroon's conflict-ridden southwest. He joined the movement in 2017 at the age of 23 after local fighters came to his village and offered him a chance to turn his frustrations with the government into action. Like many in the English-speaking parts of Cameroon, he says he felt marginalized by the government dominated by the French-speaking population. Those tensions, beginning with peaceful protests organized by lawyers and teachers, turned deadly following a government crackdown. As a rebel, Tajua lived under plastic sheets in the rain, cooked for the leaders, and carried out attacks on military and civilian targets. I've been speaking to him and began by asking him when and why did he decide to join the group.
I cannot say the exact date since it's been several years, but I know it was right at the beginning of the Anglophone conflict. On that day, the Red Dragons, led by Fimasha Oliver Likiaka, stormed the neighborhood and promised almost every young person that was there, to include myself, that we were to fight government forces and to better our living conditions. One of the highest things that made me accept their request was the fact that we greatly suffered from the defense and security forces, most especially those at checkpoints on the way, since I used to be a rider and a part-time teacher too. From 2014 to 2016.
So how old were you, and did you at the time have an understanding of what it is the Red Dragons did?
By then, I just left the university. I'd spent just a single year in the university after my advanced level. I really understood that fighting against a state had consequences, but I didn't know the modus operandi of the Third Revolution would become what it is today.
Right. Were there other people that you found in the militia group that were of similar age to yours?
Yeah, there were people of the similar age. There were others who were quite younger.
How young are we talking?
We had people who were not even up to 15. Someone like Ajua Jeremiah, who was the second to die in Yabialem, was not up to 15.
So when you joined the militia, what were you thinking? Because obviously you've changed your mind today.
That's very true. At the moment, my intention was to fight against the state authorities to make things better for myself and for other Anglophones.
Talk to us about what you did as a member of the Red Dragons and the kind of assignments that you are asked to execute.
One of my prime function there, since I had been a rider, I used to transport the fighters to and fro. I also participated in cooking and in many other activities that, due to the fact that things are so fresh in people's mind, will not only be better exposing certain things, but I want to believe I participated in most activities in 2018, because I later abandoned the so-called crisis in March 2019.
Were you sent out on some missions, perhaps?
Of course. One of the key things is, you know, you can't just join a group as a new person and you are given an AK-47 to manipulate. First of all, up to date, I didn't know there was a gun called the AK-47 until I saw you with gendarmes on the way. We in LBLM do not have military camps where we could even know how to operate a gun. I had to spend some time with them. I had to be taught on how to operate an automatic rifle and the rest. One of the most things I regret, which I participated in, was the burning of Bangang that I can't refuse. I was part of those who did it under Ayeke.
And how did you feel carrying out those things?
Back then, it didn't trouble me. But from the very second I started reflecting, when I discovered that the mode of operation had changed. In fact, my life has never been the same. I live in agony. I keep reflecting, most especially when I watch certain videos. They play over me. Right. And that is why at times I don't even love talking about it, because it plays over my psychology.
And so today you are a teacher. Tell us about the day you left the militia and what changed your mind.
Nothing changed. Rather, I discovered that the mode of operation had changed to something else. There was a lot of infighting between the Red Dragons and the guerrillas of our law, which were once the same camp under Oliver Lekiaka, a.k.a. Fimasha. Later on, his second in command, known as Ayeke, created his own camp named the Guerrillas of Alo. There was a lot of infighting. Many were killed. And the main thing that provoked me to surrender was the fact that I lost my own biological child during a military raid in our camp.
Are you able to give us more details on what happened on the day of the raid?
I remember when the military attacked my wife-to-be, because I wasn't officially married by then, who was there with us in the camp. I was sleeping with her in one of the small rooms. Out of a sudden, at about 5 a.m. in the morning, we got gunshot being fired everywhere. I couldn't check on my wife. All I could do was to save my own life. I escaped, then later on discovered my wife too had escaped. We came back to discover that my 11-year-old child was dead. I cannot explain what happened because I didn't stand to see it.
So you decide to leave the Red Dragons. Was it simple to actually just disengage from the group?
It could never be a simple decision. First of all, I was going to join who I had long considered an enemy. Previously, the military was my enemy. So it took me a lot of time. I had to grow pay. I pondered upon everything, and later on told my wife I prefer to go die rather than dying here, since I had carried several corpses. Most of my mates were already dead. I knew if I do not surrender, the next thing is I would die. It's better I go and die out so that others will know, rather than saying I remain in the bush under the rain and die as a terrorist.
And yes, when you surrendered, what happened after that?
So I was the first person in LBLM to officially surrender and go to the DDRO center. It wasn't easy. I was kept incommunicado for some days in Menji Fontem, but due to the intervention of the divisional officer for Fontem, who is today the divisional officer for Batsibo in Momo Division, I was taken up to Alo Subdivision, which is at the boundary with the West Region, then later on sent to Boya at the DDRO Center. When I got to the DDRO Center, things were different. Things were not the way I thought. I wasn't beaten, but I was locked up and my phones taken by the military authorities who were there for some days. My family even thought I was dead.
So from that point onwards, how did you get back to teaching again?
I was taken up to Alo, and from Alo I was sent to the DDRO Center in Boya. I spent about 1 year, 6 months there. While there, I was trained as a driver. But the unfortunate thing with the trainings at the DDRO was the fact that no license was given. So I kept explaining to the authorities that, no, I think I need to go hustle for my life. I have children. I have a wife living somewhere. They took good care of me, but there was no one to take care of my own family. So through the coordinator for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Center knew me well. He gave me that permission. I left, went back to the West Region, returned to university. I spent 5 years in July 2024. I was already 5 years in the university. From then, I decided to embark on my part-time teaching. I decided to return into the classroom where today I am a logic part-time logic teacher.
Could you tell us about this DDR process and center that you're talking about and what they do, if you could help our listeners understand that?
The DDR stands for National Center for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration. It's a commission created in Cameroon, I think, at the end of the Major National Dialogue, which harbors former separatist fighters and former Boko Haram fighters. The first stage there is for you, first of all, to accept the fact that what you were doing is wrong. Laid hand over your weapon to state authorities, get there, then you start the demobilization process. You are being de-radicalized, you are taught, you are being trained on certain professions. If you don't want to be trained, you are not forced into such trainings. Then the last section is being reintegrated into the society. When those responsible for the DDR finally discover that your mentality is no longer the same, you are now qualified to return into the society, you are being reintegrated.
Tell me if you're pupils and their parents and also your colleagues know about your past and what they say about it.
Some of them know about my past. Most of my colleagues know about my past since I am peace advocate on the social media. I don't care what they think. I won't say exactly their mind because I don't know. It doesn't trouble me because I do not live in the past. I'm a new person. What matters is what I do at the moment and not what I did.
And finally, what message do you try to install in the pupils and in the students that you teach in terms of promoting peace?
I always tell them guns will never resolve any problem. Guns are never the solution. I think the error I did out of ignorance should not be committed by the same students I teach. As a teacher, it is my obligation to let them know that only pens can solve a solution.
Atiasong Belt Tajua. Focus on Africa was put together by Sunita Nahar, Stefania Okereke, Yvette Togira Maria, and Bella Hassan in London. Connie Sharp was a senior journalist in charge, and Philip Bull was a technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again soon.